Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading news stories from Reuters for Thursday, August 20, 2026. Russian strikes kill 16 in Ukraine. Zelensky says lack of patriots costs lives. By Daniel Flynn and Anna Puchnika. Kyiv. A major Russian airstrike killed 16 people and injured more than 40 in Kyiv and the surrounding region on Thursday, as President Volodymyr Zelensky said a failure by Ukraine's allies to replenish its stock of air defense missiles was costing lives. Ukraine's Air Force said Russia launched dozens of cruise missiles, as well as ballistic and hypersonic ones, and 168 drones in the massive overnight attack. The Air Force said that nearly 90% of the drones and most of the cruise missiles were downed. It did not specify how many ballistic missiles were launched and whether any were intercepted. Zelensky called Thursday's strike one of the most cynical, calculated, and large-scale of the four-and-a-half-year-long war. The upper floors of a 9-story residential block were destroyed in Kyiv's Solomianskyi district, Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said. He called for Friday to be observed as a day of mourning. Overall, 30 residential buildings, a school, a children's hospital, and a kindergarten were damaged in the capital and the surrounding areas, Zelensky said. Private energy company DTEC said it had restored power to some 90,000 households that lost the supply after the attack. The Russian Defense Ministry said Moscow attacked Kyiv and the surrounding region with airstrikes and drones, hitting facilities producing drone components, a military depot, and a logistics hub, as well as other targets. The Russian strikes also targeted a border crossing with Moldova in the Black Sea region of Odessa, where repeated attacks on ports and ships have brought Ukraine's vital agricultural exports to a virtual halt in recent weeks, pressuring global food prices. As Russia has escalated its ballistic strikes in recent months, Zelensky has pleaded with allies to replenish Ukraine's stock of Patriot interceptors, the only weapon in its arsenal capable of downing a ballistic missile. The interceptors for Patriot systems have not yet been replaced, and they are needed every day, Zelensky said on the Telegram app. Each additional missile saves the lives of our people. Moscow, he said, would not seriously negotiate for peace as long as Ukraine had no missile defenses to defend its cities. U.S.-mediated talks to end the war stalled earlier this year as Kyiv refused to yield to Russian demands to cede more territory. Unfortunately, the world's response to such attacks is not always adequate, Zelensky said. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said on X, in response to Zelensky's message, that she was working with member states and partners to provide Ukraine with anti-ballistic capabilities as the most urgent of priorities. Ukrainian Prime Minister Sergei Koretsky said that some food warehouses and the facilities of the Red Cross around Kyiv were damaged in the attack, which lasted nearly 9 hours. In recent weeks, fresh fruit and vegetables have occasionally disappeared from the shelves in some supermarkets in Kyiv as a result of strikes on logistics depots of food retailers. At the missile damaged apartment block in Solomianskyi district, an elderly woman wailed as rescuers carried out the body of her grandson, Reuters TV showed. She stood sobbing beside his body after he was placed on the ground, before medics moved in to support her. While most of the dead were in the Ukrainian capital, one person was also killed in the surrounding region, an official said on Telegram. Ukraine has also increased its attacks on Russia, targeting oil facilities and logistics infrastructure to try to undermine Moscow's ability to wage war. Overnight, authorities in Russia's Tatarstan region, 1,000 kilometers or 620 miles east of Moscow, reported a disruption at an industrial complex in the city of Nizhnekamsk following a Ukrainian drone attack, adding that some residential apartments were also damaged. Ukraine's military said it hit the Taneyko oil refinery and an oil terminal in Krasnodar region. A drone crashed into Romania, a NATO and European Union member state, during the Russian attack on Ukraine, the Romanian Defense Ministry said. A drone also came down on Moldovan territory, President Maia Sandu said. Ukraine has handed peace proposals to U.S. negotiators Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner for a plan to end the war, Zelensky said this month. The Kremlin said on Thursday there was no information yet on a possible visit to Moscow by Kushner and Witkoff, who were last in the Russian capital in January and have not yet visited Kyiv. No date has yet been confirmed for a proposed visit to Ukraine, according to one source familiar with the discussions. Poland arrests man over alleged plot to assassinate Ukrainian arms industry official. By Reuters. Warsaw. Poland has arrested a Ukrainian man suspected of attempting to assassinate a representative of Ukraine's arms industry on behalf of Russian intelligence services, prosecutors in the Internal Security Agency, ABW, said on Thursday. Western countries and Ukraine have long accused Russia of recruiting people, including Ukrainians, to carry out sabotage and espionage. Russia has repeatedly denied the allegations. The Russian embassy in Poland did not immediately respond to an emailed request for comment. The suspect, identified only as Serhiy P. after Polish privacy laws, is accused of trying to kill a representative of Ukraine's arms industry in Irpin, near Kyiv. The investigation revealed that Serhiy P. planted an improvised explosive device under a car used by a potential victim, ABW said in a statement. The device was intended to be detonated remotely using a cell phone. The mechanism did not detonate due to a malfunction, it added. After the failed attempt, the suspect fled to Poland, where he was arrested in Warsaw. He was charged with attempted murder using explosives and possession of explosives without the required permit. He faces a minimum sentence of 15 years in prison or life imprisonment, prosecutors said. The case demonstrates that Russian intelligence services conduct operations that transcend national borders and utilize individuals traveling between countries, ABW said. Earlier this month, Poland arrested a Russian citizen accused of being recruited by Moscow to kill a Ukrainian-American citizen in Warsaw. German prosecutors say second Nord Stream suspect arrested in Croatia. By Ludwig Burger. Frankfurt. German prosecutors said on Wednesday a second Ukrainian suspect, they allege, was involved in the 2022 Nord Stream pipeline blasts, has been arrested in Croatia and will be extradited to Germany. The first suspect in the case, former Ukrainian Army officer Serhiy K., was charged by prosecutors in July with orchestrating the blasts while acting on behalf of Ukrainian state entities. The Ukrainian national, who was arrested in Italy in August 2025 and transferred to Germany in November, has denied any involvement in the blasts near the Danish island of Bornholm. Authorities in Kyiv have said they did not have enough information to respond in detail to the German allegations. Germany's Federal Prosecutor's Office identified the second Ukrainian national only as Vladimir Z. in a statement, adding that he was arrested in the Croatian city of Pula by local police forces who acted on a European arrest warrant. The prosecutor said Vladimir Z. was a trained scuba diver who was part of a group led by Serhiy K. that planted explosives targeting to the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 gas pipelines. Reuters could not immediately reach Vladimir Z. or a legal representative for comment. The Istarska County Police Administration told Reuters that the Istrian police had made an arrest in a tourist facility in Pula on Wednesday morning and were checking to confirm if the person was the one wanted by the federal court in Karlsruhe. "We are not able to confirm the identity of the arrested person at this moment," the police said in a statement. A lawyer in Poland told Polish state news agency PAP that the man detained in Croatia was Vladimir Z., whom he had represented last year when a Polish court ruled against his extradition to Germany. I can confirm that today my client in a trial in Poland was detained in Croatia. I don't know the reasons he went there, but I assume they must have been significant and important, PAP quoted Timotej Paproki as saying. The Croatian Justice Ministry said in a statement that it had not received official information about the arrest, but added that under European Union law, authorized judicial bodies communicated with each other directly on extradition matters. In this case, it would be for the Pula court to decide, the Justice Ministry added. Russia and Western countries have described the September 2022 explosions, which followed Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine earlier that year, as sabotage. The explosions damaged the Nord Stream 1 pipeline, a vital route for Russian gas exports to Europe, as well as the Nord Stream 2 branch, which had yet to enter service. At the time, Moscow had recently halted gas deliveries via Nord Stream 1, blaming Western sanctions and technical issues, though Europe accused it of weaponizing energy supplies. The German prosecutors have said the aim of the alleged attack was to permanently halt gas deliveries through the pipelines and thereby prevent Russia from using revenue from the national gas trade to finance its war effort. German courts have treated the case as falling within their jurisdiction because the damaged pipelines end in the German state of Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, and their loss affected Germany's energy security and internal safety. A decade after earthquake, Italy's Amatrice struggles to rebuild. By Crispian Balmer. Amatrice, Italy. In the early hours of August 24, 2016, Giorgio Cortellesi stumbled through the dust and darkness of Amatrice, fearing his children were dead, buried beneath tons of rubble. His two young sons had been staying overnight with their grandparents when an earthquake leveled much of the central Italian hill town. Rushing over from a nearby hamlet, Cortellesi found the streets in ruins, muffled cries rising from collapsed homes. Then he caught the sound of one of his sons calling for help. "I didn't think I would find them alive, but when I heard his voice, it was as if I started breathing again," said Cortellesi. He promised himself that if his boys survived, he would help rebuild Amatrice, which bore the brunt of the calamity, with 237 people dying in the town, out of a total death toll of 303. Elected town mayor in 2021, Cortellesi is trying to make good on his pledge, but it isn't easy. The 6.2 magnitude earthquake and aftershocks destroyed much of Amatrice's historic center and many outlying areas, leaving several thousand people homeless. The state has promised to pay for the vast bulk of the reconstruction and has so far approved private and public sector projects worth 22.7 billion euros, $26.3 billion, across the disaster zone. Around 10 billion euro has been paid out to date. In Amatrice, 38% of the damaged properties have been restored, with the pace of building picking up markedly over the past 12 months. Cranes dot the town, and clusters of pristine new homes have sprouted amidst the desolation. Even so, only a small proportion of the structures flattened in 2016 have been rebuilt. Much of the historic center remains behind barriers, where two lone towers that survived the earthquake gaze over the blasted wasteland. Around 1,000 people, roughly 60% of the population, still live in small, prefabricated shelters, while each year a few families drift away, seeking a brighter future elsewhere. "After 10 years, many people have lost faith," said Cortellesi. "We need to keep on encouraging them, but we can't do more than we are already doing." As with other major Italian earthquakes, such as L'Aquila in 2009, Amatrice's reconstruction got bogged down in bureaucracy, legal disputes, and shifting priorities. The COVID-19 pandemic disrupted rebuilding efforts, while Italy's generous super bonus renovation scheme, intended to revive the virus-hit economy, pushed up the cost of building materials and siphoned off labor to more lucrative projects across Italy. The super bonus led to an almost total stop that lasted 2 years. It was a disaster, said Cortellesi. Rebuilding densely packed medieval neighborhoods was complicated by multiple owners, inheritance disputes, and unresolved property claims that made every planning application a legal minefield. Officials say fears of mafia interference in the adjudication of multi-million euro contracts added further layers of scrutiny that snarled some projects for years. Yet for some survivors, the slow pace of reconstruction has been only one part of a much deeper struggle to remain. Daniele Bonanni lost his mother, sister, and nephew in the earthquake, leaving just him, his niece, and her baby daughter alive. A sought-after chef, Bonanni could easily have moved on. Instead, he stayed put. "It seemed wrong to abandon the place where I grew up and where my family built a life," he said. "Perhaps it was a mistake. Even today, I cannot say for certain." For years, descendants of Amatrice families returned each August to homes inherited from parents and grandparents, but many of those properties were lost. "People once came for the summer. Now they come for lunch," said Bonanni, who runs a chic restaurant in a food village established for chefs who had lost their businesses. "If you create a generational break of 10 or 15 years, the bond dies," he said. Few embody the frustrations of reconstruction more than brother and sister Alfredo and Elisabetta Perilli. They lost many relatives and their respective homes in the center of Amatrice. Alfredo still has to pay the mortgage on his old house, trapping him financially. "The building no longer exists, but the bank wants its money every month," he said. The Perillis also lost their family-run restaurant and hotel, with the land it once occupied now serving as a temporary access route for the reconstruction of a hospital. Building work was scheduled to finish in 2022. Until they get their site back, they cannot submit reconstruction plans for approval. "If they go on much longer, I won't have the strength to start rebuilding," said Elisabetta. Such delays have left Cortellesi wondering whether some of the choices made after the earthquake were the right ones, including the core decision to recreate much of the town on its original site and largely in its former image. "What we will have is a facsimile," he said, acknowledging that much of the medieval masonry had gone. Personally, I would have redesigned the town in a modern way," he said. "Once everything had been wiped away, I think something new could have been created, but it's too late to turn back." Migrant women tell of sexual harassment in Spain's crisis-hit Ceuta, by Maria Cardona and David Latona. Ceuta, Spain. Some women who entered Spain's North African enclave of Ceuta on July 30 as part of a mass migrant crossing say the hardships of sleeping rough as they wait to be registered are compounded by the threat and fear of sexual harassment. More than a dozen women have set up camp on a wooded roadside running up to the barbed wire fencing that surrounds the government-run migrant reception center near the urban beach of El Trampolín. The facility is sheltering about 700 people, 200 more than capacity, according to local authorities. Camped outside, the women are sleeping in the open air along with hundreds of other Moroccan, sub-Saharan, and South Asian migrants. Reuters spoke to three women there, who said that some men, also staying in the vicinity, are harassing them. Authorities say that between 5,000 and 8,000 people remain in the enclave, more than 2 weeks after 72,000 people crossed from Morocco in a deadly border surge. Most of them were young men, and many have returned to Morocco. But a significant number of women and children also made the crossing. Police and social services say they are scrambling to expand limited reception facilities in Ceuta. And as of Tuesday, 2,168 children have been registered, along with 500 adult asylum applications as of last week. Wafai Atid, a soft-spoken 28-year-old from the northern Moroccan city of Tassa, told Reuters that as she waits for the Spanish authorities to look at her case, she and more than a dozen other women had set up a makeshift camp with cardboard boxes, inflatable mattresses, and blankets as close as possible to a police van stationed at the center's entrance for safety. "It's really bad. A lot of guys are trying to attack the girls every night. Sometimes just when you go to the toilet, they follow you," Atid said. "It's different nationalities, Africans, Arabs." The SUP, Spain's largest police union, said 15 sexual assaults of varying degrees of severity had been reported in Ceuta since July 30, the significant majority of whose victims were underage. In a statement to Reuters, it said the majority of alleged assaults occurred in the beach and wooded zones where migrants were concentrated. It suggested that many crimes would be difficult to prosecute because of the generic information provided by victims. Women who reported assaults had been attended to by police, judicial, and health authorities, SUP added, and they were now being housed in a new center for sexual assault victims provided by local social services. It called for the expansion of Ceuta Police's Women and Families Unit and more civilian safety patrols of the makeshift camps. Spain's Interior Ministry and police declined to confirm the figure or give further details. In a statement this week, Ceuta's court authorities confirmed they had processed three cases of sexual assault of migrant women allegedly committed by Moroccan migrants who arrived in the city during the mass influx. Two of the cases involved victims who were minors, one who was allegedly sexually assaulted by penetration and forced to sell drugs, another who was indecently touched. In both cases, the accused men have been jailed on remand, while in a third, an adult woman alleged that she was indecently assaulted and the alleged assailant's deportation was ordered by the judge. The deportation of another man who broke into a private home and climbed into the bed of a local woman in his underpants was also ordered on a charge of breaking and entering. Spanish Interior Ministry figures for 2024, the latest full year for which data is available, show there were 42 sexual assaults and 5 rapes reported in Ceuta, a landmass that is a third the size of Manhattan and has 84,000 inhabitants. Spain's Interior, Migration, and Equality Ministries did not respond to Reuters' questions about the allegations of sexual violence and threat. Spain's Health Minister, Monica Garcia, confirmed that medical services had treated 5 women for sexual violence and said the most urgent healthcare challenge was putting a roof over migrants' heads. "The best way to protect women and children is to ensure they are in safe places," she said. On Monday, Migration and Social Security Minister Elma Saiz, also visiting the enclave, said authorities and the Red Cross were distributing 4,000 meals daily, along with female hygiene kits, and that temporary reception centers with 1,500 further places were being set up. "The government was committed to providing humanitarian attention," she said. Several human rights organizations operating in Ceuta or specialized in sexual violence, including Save the Children, the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, and Amnesty International, have warned of the extreme vulnerability of migrant women and particularly girls in Ceuta and called for urgent measures including safe housing and specialist support. "When large volumes of displaced persons are together in overcrowded spaces, these situations of sexual violence arise," said Lucila Rodriguez Alarcón, Director General of the Por Causa Foundation, adding it was necessary to segregate toilets and showers by gender and apply the same safety protocols as in refugee camps. Atid said she was unable to sleep at night because she was afraid. instead resting between 7 a.m. and noon in the relative safety of daylight. The woman had no access to separate showers, and her periods had stopped with the stress of her situation, she added. Nonetheless, she said she would rather live on the street in Spain than remain in Morocco, which she said she left because her religious family did not accept her lack of belief in Islam. Atid's neighbor at the camp, Dikra Tetuan, 20, crossed into Ceuta with her 17-year-old sister, Aya. She said women in their improvised camp faced repeated harassment and sexual assault. "We try to protect ourselves by screaming so that people gather around us," Tetuan said. Tetuan said police had told the women there was little they could do. Spain's interior ministry declined to comment, and neither the national police nor civil guard immediately responded to requests for comment. Aftershocks rattle Spain's Granada overnight. By Reuters. Madrid. At least 10 earthquakes struck Granada in southern Spain overnight, authorities said on Wednesday, continuing seismic activity that began in the region 5 days ago and has caused light injuries and damage to buildings. Many shops, churches, and museums were closed while the local government shuttered offices as a precaution. Local media reported that some residents fled to the coast, while others opted to stay outdoors for fear of structures collapsing. The strongest quake of the sequence was of magnitude 3.4 at 10:35 p.m. on Tuesday, with its epicenter in Ogijares, 7 kilometers or 4 miles south of Granada City, according to the National Geographic Institute, IGN. It was followed by 9 tremors between 1.5 and 2.5 magnitude and dozens of smaller aftershocks. Health services said they treated 14 cases, mostly panic or anxiety attacks, and more than 500 calls were made to emergency services. About 600 people were evacuated from apartment blocks that required inspection, Andalusian official Antonio Sanz told reporters on Tuesday. "There's clearly no imminent danger and the public hasn't been at risk," Sanz said, adding that it was still impossible to determine the full extent of the damage, though preliminary assessments suggested it was limited to cornices and facades rather than serious structural issues. Paqui Valero, a resident of Albolote on Granada's outskirts, told local newspaper Ideal that she and her partner abandoned work to drive south with their 2 children on a jammed highway. "I felt a lot of panic," she said. Prince Harry and Meghan to make shock return to Britain after moving to U.S. By Michael Holden and Lisa Richwine. London, Los Angeles. Prince Harry and his wife Meghan plan to move back to Britain this month, 6 years after they quit royal duties and relocated to the U.S., from where they repeatedly criticized the royal family and lambasted the British press. A person close to the couple said they would move from California to somewhere outside London for an extended period, with their children, Prince Archie, 7, and Princess Lilibet, 5, who will go to school in Britain. The surprise news marks the latest twist for a couple who railed against a string of British institutions after they left in 2020, with Harry accusing the royals of neglect, the tabloid press of ruining his life, and the government of failing to provide enough security for him to ever return home. King Charles, who media reports said welcomed having his youngest son and his family closer, only found out about the move on Sunday. Harry and Meghan will not live in a royal residence and will remain non-working royals, as agreed with the late Queen Elizabeth. Harry's spokesperson in Buckingham Palace declined to comment. Harry married Meghan Markle at Windsor Castle in 2018, and it was hoped his union with the former actor would reinvigorate the historic institution for a new generation. But it was not long before cracks in their relationship with the rest of the royal family began to emerge. 2 years later, in March 2020, they announced they would step down from official duties and moved to the U.S., saying they wanted to leave behind the toxic press scrutiny they faced in Britain. They settled in the wealthy seaside enclave of Montecito near Santa Barbara, California, with media reports putting the 2020 purchase price of their 16-bedroom home at $14.7 million, a property which they will keep. In the following years, Harry, now 41, and Meghan, 45, repeatedly hit out at the royal family and the monarchy in TV interviews, a Netflix documentary series, and most notably in Harry's memoir, Spare. During a 2021 interview with Oprah Winfrey, Meghan, whose mother is black, said an unnamed member of the family had asked how dark their son Archie's skin might be. Heir to the throne, Prince William, Harry's elder brother, responded by denying that Britain's royals were racist. Harry also had some particularly barbed comments for his father, Charles, and William, leading to a total breakdown in their relationship. He later criticized the British government after it changed his security arrangements and said the lack of automatic police protection meant he was unable to bring his children to Britain. But relations with the king, who was undergoing treatment for an unspecified cancer, appeared to be thawing in September, and father and son met briefly for the first time in 20 months. Last month, Harry, Meghan, and their children visited Britain, and Charles saw his grandchildren for the first time since 2022. While Harry and the king's relationship might have improved, he is still barely on speaking terms with his brother. Harry had always said he wanted his children to spend more time in Britain, but a former senior royal aide said the return would pose challenges for everyone involved, adding that royals who try to forge private careers are often accused by critics of exploiting their position. The former aide said the news would be particularly difficult for William and his wife, Kate, after Harry and Meghan dumped all over the institution, the members of the family, and the country from a great height for money. Prime Minister Andy Burnham, asked if the taxpayer would fund their security needs, said it was a private matter for the couple, and he wished them well. Harry and Meghan embarked on several media ventures from their California home, signing multi-million dollar deals with Spotify for a podcast series and with Netflix for programming, including a lifestyle show hosted by Meghan. The projects produced mixed results. Harry's tell-all book was a bestseller, but their podcast deal ended and Meghan's Netflix show was not renewed for a third season. In recent months, Meghan, who has launched a lifestyle brand, has published an increasing number of photographs on her Instagram account showing Harry and their children and their U.S. life, often taken from behind the children to hide their faces. "They didn't achieve the superstar status they wanted," said Dominic Patton, executive editor of Hollywood publication Deadline.com, adding, however, that they had kept the public interested for a long time, which is not easy in a town full of big-name celebrities. Royal commentator Afua Hagen said that interest would ramp up in Britain as they return, with newspapers wanting to know where they would live and where the children would go to school. She said while they were essentially walking back into the lion's den, they were better prepared this time. "They're not bringing a knife to a gunfight. They know what they have to do and what they're going to come up against and will prepare themselves better." North Korea launches 10 ballistic missiles as U.S.-South Korea drills near end. By Joyce Lee and Kyu Sok-shim. Seoul. South Korea's presidential office condemned North Korea's launch of more than 10 short-range ballistic missiles on Thursday and ordered its military to maintain full readiness during ongoing joint exercises with the United States. The launch came after North Korea's Kim Yo-jong, sister of Kim Jong-un, on Wednesday condemned the U.S.-South Korea military drills, despite U.S. President Donald Trump's order to substantially reduce U.S. participation in the exercises. The presidential office convened an emergency security meeting attended by officials from the Defense Ministry and military authorities after North Korea fired the missiles from the Pyongyang area toward the sea to the east of the Korean Peninsula, it said in a statement. The ballistic missile launch is a grave act that violates UN Security Council resolutions, it said, calling on North Korea to immediately halt such actions. The missiles flew around 300 kilometers, 186 miles, toward the sea, South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said. South Korean Defense Minister An Kyu-bak told lawmakers that the short-range ballistic missiles are believed to be 600-millimeter multiple rocket launchers, adding that Seoul has been tracking them because they could be potentially deployed near its border with the South. North Korea has previously described the 600-millimeter system, known externally as the KN-25, as being able to deliver tactical nuclear warheads. An said earlier in the day that North Korea possesses between 80 and 120 nuclear warheads. Military drills by South Korea and the U.S. were cut short to end on Friday after President Donald Trump ordered a substantial reduction in U.S. participation and said he wanted to revive diplomacy with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Trump said on Monday he had received a response from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un after the reduction. But Kim's sister, Kim Yo-jong, said on Wednesday she was unaware of any recent communications between the two countries' leaders, while saying the United States' hostile policy towards North Korea had not changed. Yang Moo-jin, a professor at the University of North Korean Studies in Seoul, said the launch appeared aimed at underscoring that Kim Jong-un's warning a day earlier was not mere rhetoric. He said the launch likely served multiple purposes, including signaling opposition to the South Korea-U.S. military exercises, expressing displeasure over recent discussion of North Korea's nuclear arsenal, and warning outside powers against speculation about Pyongyang's security affairs. It is a message that matters concerning North Korea's security. It is a message that matters concerning North Korea's security are for North Korea to decide, Yang said, adding the launch could also have been used to test improved missile systems. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, who visited Seoul this week, urged South Korea not to take sides between Beijing and Washington, saying the U.S. should abandon its hostile policy toward North Korea to ease tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Colombia's president pegs early quake losses at $9.6 billion. By Nelson Bocanegra and Luis Jaime Acosta. Bogota. The economic losses from a powerful earthquake that struck Colombia last week are expected to reach 30 trillion pesos, $9.58 billion, Colombia's president Abelardo de la Espriella said on Monday. De la Espriella said the impact included roughly 24.5 trillion pesos in buildings and 5.5 trillion pesos in infrastructure. Just imagine the scale of the disaster, De la Espriella said, noting that the figures were likely to change. This is a preliminary figure that will be adjusted as we obtain more information and as the damage caused by this earthquake is assessed in each of the regions. The 7.4 magnitude quake toppled buildings in various parts of western Colombia, including the major cities of Cali and Pereira, killing 280 people, injuring more than 4,000, and leaving another 143 people missing. By comparison, the earthquakes that struck neighboring Venezuela on June 24 caused damage to housing and infrastructure estimated at $37 billion, according to an initial assessment by the United Nations Office for Disaster Risk Reduction published last month. The Colombia quake is the first major crisis facing De la Espriella, who took office just days before and now must oversee relief and reconstruction efforts. El Niño rains in Peru disrupt access to Machu Picchu. By Reuters. Lima. Heavy rains linked to the El Niño weather phenomenon caused flooding in Peru on Wednesday that disrupted access to the ancient Inca citadel of Machu Picchu, closed roads due to landslides, and flooded homes in the capital, Lima. Peruvian authorities ordered the Inca Trail, a main tourist route to Machu Picchu, closed until Saturday due to overflowing waterways and debris, according to local media. El Niño, a weather phenomenon that warms the Pacific Ocean surface, causes intense rains and droughts across Latin America, is already impacting Peru's fishing and agriculture. Flooding from heavy rains in Lima collapsed water and sewage services, filled dozens of homes, and prompted class suspensions in three southern districts of the city. "We've lost everything, my furniture, my refrigerator that my children just gave me for Mother's Day, it's all ruined. The stove, all my appliances that they just gave me, everything is ruined," said Flora Gonzalez, whose Lima home was flooded. Road closures from landslides also affected the southern regions of Arequipa and Moquegua. Southern Copper, one of the country's leading copper producers, said operations in the south of the country had not been impacted. Peru is the world's third largest copper producer. Top Canada-U.S. trade negotiators to meet again as deal deadline nears. By Promit Mukherjee. Ottawa. Top trade negotiators from Canada and the U.S. will meet for the second day running in Washington on Thursday in a bid to finalize a trade deal that could help reduce months of tariffs and counter-duties. Canada's minister responsible for trade with the U.S., Dominic LeBlanc, is due to meet U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer on Thursday at 12:15 p.m., his office said. Canada's chief trade negotiator, Janice Charette, will also attend the meeting. LeBlanc and Greer met on Wednesday and reported significant progress toward a deal that would stave off a U.S. threat to impose extra tariffs starting on Saturday. Separately, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is scheduled to meet Canadian Foreign Minister Anita Anand at the White House later on Thursday. The meetings come as the U.S. and Canada close in on a deal under which Washington could reduce tariffs on Canadian-built cars and trucks as well as steel and aluminum, a source familiar with the matter told Reuters on Wednesday. The proposed deal is expected to cut the top-line tariff on Canadian-built vehicles to 15% from 25% and halve tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum to 25%, the source said. U.S. President Donald Trump said on Wednesday that Washington would make some tariff concessions and suggested that a deal would also remove Canadian tariffs on U.S. goods. Prime Minister Mark Carney briefed Canada's provincial premiers after LeBlanc's meeting with Greer on Wednesday. Some of the premiers later noted that Carney urged them to end a ban on U.S. alcohol, which is a particular irritant for Washington, if Canada manages to reach a deal with the U.S. The U.S. and Canada, long-standing trading partners whose economies are deeply integrated, have been embroiled in a trade dispute since Trump imposed tariffs on imports of Canadian steel, aluminum, and vehicles last year, prompting countermeasures from Ottawa. Trump this week postponed until 12:01 a.m. on Saturday a new 50% tariff on about $20 billion worth of Canadian goods, citing progress in negotiations and a deal subject to finalization of documents. U.S. debt crosses $40 trillion threshold after doubling under Trump and Biden. By David Lauder and Jacob Bocage. Washington. Total U.S. debt has topped $40 trillion for the first time, the Treasury Department said on Wednesday, drawing fresh warnings that a fiscal crisis is brewing as ballooning costs, as ballooning costs for social safety net programs and interest payments far outstrip revenues held back by tax cuts. The Treasury's latest daily cash and debt balances statement showed total public debt outstanding at $40.047 trillion on Tuesday, a total that includes Treasury securities held by the public of $32.266 trillion and intragovernmental debt holdings of $7.782 trillion. The federal government's IOU has now more than doubled in less than a decade, from $19.95 trillion when President Donald Trump was sworn in for the first time in January 2017. Roughly one-third of that increase occurred during 2 years of frantic government borrowing to fund the COVID-19 pandemic responses undertaken by Trump and former President Joe Biden, while the fiscal policy choices of both presidents, combined with long-running tax and spending imbalances, account for the rest. Budget watchdog groups have anticipated crossing the threshold for weeks and issued stark warnings that a full-blown debt crisis could erupt unless lawmakers confront an unsustainable fiscal outlook and raise taxes, cut spending, or both. $40 trillion of debt doesn't exist solely on the government's ledgers. It is felt throughout the economy and finds its way to the pocketbooks of people one way or another, said Maya McGuinness, president of the Nonpartisan Committee for Responsible Federal Budget. The more we borrow, the more we exacerbate inflation, squeeze out other priorities in the budget, and leave ourselves vulnerable to emergencies at home and turmoil abroad, McGuinness said in a statement just after the Treasury data was released. She said the $40 trillion figure was reached less than 5 months after debt reached $39 trillion, and has quadrupled in less than 20 years, after taking until 1981 to reach $1 trillion for the first time. It is staggering how predictable the fiscal decline of a global power can become, McGuinness added. Global U.S. creditors may already be growing wary, with demand from foreign investors holding nearly one-third of treasuries declining over the past year. Days after a $25 billion auction of 30-year Treasury bonds went off at the highest yield since 2021, yields on so-called long bonds on Tuesday hit their highest levels in nearly two decades as investors demanded greater compensation in the face of hefty U.S. government bond issuance. Yields more inversely to bond prices. Yields move inversely to bond prices. On Wednesday, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent took a bold step to push long bond yields back down, announcing a doubling of buyback sizes for 10 to 30-year treasuries to at least $4 billion per operation. Higher treasury yields at the longer end tend to push up interest rates for mortgages, car, and commercial loans. With the mountain of debt showing no signs of abating, Trump on Wednesday repeated his frequent demand for lower rates. Asked at the White House whether Americans should worry about bond market volatility, Trump said, "I don't think so at all. I think we have a very powerful country, and we're borrowing through these ridiculous interest rates. They're ridiculous. Look, when our country is strong, interest rates should go down." The Treasury last week reported the fourth highest monthly deficit in U.S. history, $432 billion for July, as tariff refunds turned customs receipts negative for the third month in a row, and outlays for Social Security and Medicare benefits for seniors continued to grow. The deficit for the first 10 months of fiscal 2026 has already exceeded the total gap for all of fiscal 2025, with 2 months to go in the current fiscal year. Trump has largely ignored the dwindling number of fiscal hawks in his Republican Party, championing heavy spending across his two terms. Public debt rose by $7.8 trillion during Trump's first term, with more than half of it accumulating during the pandemic response over his last 9 months in office. Since Trump took office a second time in January 2025, the U.S. debt load has increased by $3.8 trillion, for total growth of $11.6 trillion across his two terms so far. Public debt increased by $8.4 trillion during Biden's term, also marked by heavy COVID-19 recovery spending, but driven as well by big-ticket outlays for infrastructure investment, clean energy subsidies, and other priorities championed by his Democratic Party. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget estimates that the policy choices of Trump and Biden have increased the federal debt trajectory beyond what would have accumulated under the existing spending statutes when each took office. For instance, Trump's landmark second-term legislative package, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, will add another $4.7 trillion in debt, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan bookkeeper for federal lawmakers. Trump has branded his second presidency as one focused on cost-cutting, marked by early federal agency job cuts ordered by the non-governmental Department of Government Efficiency. But much of his spending reductions have targeted so-called discretionary programs, the smallest portion of the federal budget. The U.S. spends roughly $7 trillion annually, and 60% of it is earmarked for so-called mandatory programs, including payments for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans care, that generally grow to keep pace with living costs. Another $1.1 trillion pays the interest on U.S. borrowing, the cost of which rises as the debt pile grows and as interest rates climb. The 2025 fiscal year budget marked the first time debt service costs exceeded Pentagon funding. In the first 10 months of the 2026 fiscal year, interest costs have eclipsed Medicare health care outlays to become the second largest line item in the federal budget behind the Social Security pension system. The U.S. is spending more to fund the retirement and health care costs of the baby boom generation, straining the trust funds behind Social Security and Medicare, even as payroll and income tax revenues fall short of covering federal costs. Most Americans believe Trump has inappropriately profited since returning to power, Reuters Ipsos poll finds, by Jason Lang and Bo Erickson, Washington. A majority of Americans believe President Donald Trump and his family have inappropriately profited from cryptocurrency since his return to power, and that his policy decisions are influenced by his private business dealings, a new Reuters Ipsos poll found. The four-day poll, completed on Monday, found that half of Trump's own Republicans believe the president allows considerations for his business interests to influence his decisions, a striking finding for a leader who pledged to clean up corruption in Washington. Trump was born into a New York real estate family and built his name into a globally recognized brand before running for office. He earned more than $1.4 billion last year from his family's cryptocurrency ventures, including World Liberty Financial and the Trump meme coin, digital assets he has publicly championed. In March 2025, 2 months into his second term, the president called attention on social media to his self-branded crypto coin, describing it as the greatest of them all. Some 63% of respondents said it was inappropriate for Trump and his family to have profited in that way, while 32% said it was appropriate, and the rest did not answer the question. About 3 in 10 Republican respondents called the deals inappropriate, while 7 in 10 said they were appropriate. Democrats regularly highlight alleged corruption in the administration ahead of the November midterm elections that will determine control of Congress for the next 2 years, while Trump's administration has vowed to investigate alleged corruption in Democratic-run states. Trump says that he has had no day-to-day role in his family's business since returning to office, and that his investments are independently managed. He has pursued crypto-friendly policies in his second term, after courting crypto cash on the campaign trail. The White House dismissed any allegations of impropriety, saying Trump's investments were managed by the independent financial institutions. There are no conflicts of interest, White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly said in a statement, the president only acts in the best interests of the American public. But experts on presidential ethics called the current confluence of business and politics in the White House unprecedented. We have seen nothing like this before. Even the first Trump administration did not have as many complex business interests as the second Trump administration, said Richard Painter, the top ethics lawyer for Republican President George W. Bush. Some 69% of Americans, including two-thirds of independents and 9 in 10 Democrats, said they thought Trump's private business interests were influencing his presidential decisions. Americans are divided on whether corruption is worse under the Trump administration than under other recent presidents. Democrats largely think there is more graft, while Republicans are split roughly down the middle, with 56% thinking corruption is at least a little better, and the rest thinking it is steady or worse. It's concerning, said Thomas Schmidt, a semi-retired crossing guard in Cudahy, Wisconsin, who voted for Trump in 2024, but has soured on the president this year. He should be more concerned with his presidency than with his business practices. Schmidt said his biggest worries are about Trump's inability to control inflation or extract the U.S. from the war with Iran that he helped start. He doesn't think Trump is different from other presidents in mixing his business deals with politics. I think every president's done something like that. Trump campaigned ahead of his 2016 presidential victory on a promise to fight corruption in Washington, or drain the swamp, as he put it. The public's views of Trump's personal enrichment could weigh on his party in the November midterm elections, which will determine who controls Congress during the last 2 years of his term. Americans say corruption is prevalent across all levels of government, with 4 in 10 Democrats saying they are extremely angry about graft, compared with 1 in 4 Republicans. When poll respondents were asked which party was more corrupt, 41% pointed to the Democratic Party, and 49% to the Republican Party. The Reuters Ipsos poll, which was conducted online, surveyed 1,166 U.S. adults nationwide between August 14 and August 17. The results had a margin of error of 3 percentage points for all Americans and 5 points for Democrats, Republicans, and independents. That concludes this Thursday's reading from Reuters. My name is Jean, and it's been a pleasure to read for you.